and our edicts weren't completely ignored. Embassy towners had begun to do as we suggested, asked, or ordered. We, Magdar above all, worked hard at our few Arieke contacts. We worked hard full stop. Too hard for me to feel just then whatever it was I ultimately probably would, from Ez's abuse, from reading Ursel's letter. Magdar even persuaded some of the most contained and coherent Arieke into the corridors of the embassy, not simply on eager pilgrimage to Ezra, but on new business. She might reward them with a snip of unheard recording of Ezra, one of our rare stolen buggings.
"Some of them know this is a problem," said Mag. "The Arieke, you can tell."
"Some of them," said Dar. "There's some kind of debate, some of them want to be cured."
Like fucking fungus, rumours spread. Our cams still gusted through the city. Some were intercepted by the antibodies the houses secreted, which came up like segmented predators. But when their investigations left them satisfied that the cams were no threat, they left them unmolested. The footage taught us more about our host city than we had ever known. Too late. And every little half-seen movement, everything we saw out there, the what and where of which we couldn't identify or clarify, gave traction to stories about missing secrets, fifth columns, staff self-exiled, old grudges. In the farmlands, huge flocks of biorigging spawned in irregular harvests. Foods and tech came from those stretches by biotic ways. Addiction was chemical. There was a slow stream of it from the city to the kraals and the rural Arieke. They began to neglect their charges and come to the city for the sound they suddenly needed without ever having heard. Their deserted manners grew sick, wheezing and hungry. Herds of rigged equipment, medical tech and building tools, girded and rhino-sized spinners of protein and polymer foundations, went feral. When their shepherds reached the city, there was no one to meet them. The country Arieke saw their worst afflicted compatriots lying by speakers and starving to death, waiting for the next sentence. Their bodies lay unhonoured. If the buildings around them were still healthy enough, their dog-sized animalculae could break the corpses down. If not, the slower processes of internal rot would smear them gradually into the road. Fights were common. Withdrawal and Arieke need meant aggression. The afflicted would tear into things on sudden searches for Ezra's language. A less affected Ariekes, usually from the country, might frill its fan wing in formal pugnacity, but the more addicted had no time for traditional displays and would simply hurl themselves hooves and gift wings at their startled opponents. Once I saw footage of Ezra's broadcast start in the middle of such a battle. The combatants slumped against each other immediately and coiled together as if in affection, still bleeding their blood.
"Things are getting worse again," Dar said.
"We were going to infect the entire planet."
"That's not the only thing we have to contend with."
It was Bren. He stood in the doorway, a suspiciously perfect pose, all framed.
"Hello, Avis Benacho," he said.
I rose. I shook my head at him.
"You prodigal bastard," I said.
"Prodigal," he said.
"Where have you been?" "Prodigal extravagant," he said, "or penitent?"
A little cautiously, he smiled at me. I didn't quite smile at him for a minute. But then, fuck it. Yes, I did.
"How did you get in here?"
someone said, so newly promoted by circumstance that they added,
"Who are you?"
to hisses of embarrassment. Ra shook Bren's hand and tried to welcome him. Bren waved him away.
"It's not just these Ariekin refugees we have to contend with,"
Bren said,
"though they'll certainly complicate matters."
He spoke with monotone authority.
"There are other things."
Of course he couldn't speak language since his Doppel had died, but there were some Arieke, you might sentimentally and misleadingly call them old friends, that came to his house and told him things.
"Do you think none of them want this to change?"
Bren said.
"No, we know," Mag said,
but he continued.
"You think there are no hosts who are horrified? They're thinking through a fug, true, but some of them are still thinking. You know what they call Ezra? The God drug.
After a silence, I said carefully, that is a kenning.
No,
Bren said. He glanced around the room, gauging who knew that old term for the compound trope.
It's not like a bone house, Avis.
He thumped his chest, his bone house.
It's more straightforward. It's just truth.
Huh, someone said shakily. That's religion for you.
No, it is not,
Bren said.
Gods are gods, and drugs are drugs, but here, here, there's a city not only of the addicted, but of a sort of faithful.
They don't have gods, I said. How? He interrupted me.
They've known about them ever since we got here and told them what they are and what they do. They couldn't talk about void craft or trousers either before we arrived, but they find ways now. And there are some hosts who'll do anything to stop this. That might not be much yet, maybe, until they can get themselves free enough to try to free themselves more. But if they do, well, they'll end it however they can. You should think of all the ways a few determined Arieke might try to liberate afflicted compatriots.
He joined me again, in private, that night, in my rooms. He asked me where was my friend Ursel, and I told him that I didn't know. That was almost all I said that night. Bren himself didn't have much to say, but he had come, and we sat together while he said it. I left the city, 3 times. Seeing those immigrant Arieke from the outlands gave us ideas. There were some that hadn't yet left their homesteads, but had started to yearn for Ezra's pronouncements. We went to them. Our craft had ventricles through which I could put my head and look down as we flew. It exuded air in its belly bridge, pressurized enough that the bad atmosphere couldn't push in. I took breaths, then put my head out to watch the ground. 1 kilometer below, the domains of the host city. Plateaus and cultivation and simple massive rocks, fractured, their fractures filled with black weed stuff. Meadows crossed with tracks and punctuated by habitations. More grown architecture, rooms suspended by gas sacks watched us as we flew, with simple eyes. Leaving Embassy Town, and then the city, felt as dramatic as entering Imma. It might have been beautiful. Swaying through fields, even now during the breakdown, farms ambled hugely after their keepers, if they still had them, or alone. Symbionts cleaned their pelts. The farms would birth components or biomachines in wet calls. Orchards of lichen were crisscrossed with the gut pipework that spanned out from the city, still looked after in places by tenacious host tenders. A long way off were steppes where herds of semi-wild factories ran, which twice each long year Ariekian scientist gauchos would corral. We hoped to find a few of these cowboy bio-riggers left to trade their creatures' offspring. There was I, Henrik, who had been a stallholder and now had joined the new committees, Sarah, with just enough knowledge of science to be useful, Ben Thumb, the ambassador. The ambassador were unkempt, bewildered and resentful. Unlike several of their fellows, though, they had still enough decorum to ensure that they were exactly equally dishevelled. We landed, and from the hillside came the distress call of grass as our vehicles began to graze. In our Aeoli masks, we gathered equipment, made camp, called in to Embassy Town, established a timetable, checked once more over the orders and the wish list. I don't think this tribe exchanges many reactor pups, I said down the line to home. Talk to Kelsey. They're with the wetland cultivators, aren't they? That's where they'll get them, along with some incinerators. So on, we divided hunting duties between the various crews beyond the city. Our span carts were skittish, their foreparts stretched in rippling caterpillar motion. We stacked them full of dat chips, all sound files. Some were stolen, some made with Ez's grudging consent, when this system had been formulated and mooted to them. I was almost certainly not as calm as this telling would imply. I'd been looking down onto the surface of the country I was born in, grew up in, returned to, that was my home, and that view beyond Embassy Town had been impossible for me till then. So there was that, and there was what I was doing, and the stakes of it. I was looking into a season and a surface without cognates. I'd been into the out, but in homily fashion, my own planet was the most alien place I'd seen. Things like crossbred anemones and moths froze as we passed, waved sensory limbs behind us. Our cart rutted toward settlements and animals like rags of paper flew in the hot sky. The farmstead at the end of knotted, man-thick tributaries of the pipework was as restless as most architecture. A squirming tower laid young machinery in eggs. The paper-shred birds picked parasites from it. Its keepers started when they saw us, then galloped for our company. The farm lowed. So far out, the addiction seemed weaker or different. Ben Thumb could communicate our desires and understand theirs. They knew that we might have something they could hear, and they clamoured for that, unsatisfied by the degraded remnants of fix that backwashed down the arteries from the city whenever Ezra spoke, or what they half heard from the nearest speakers, kilometres away, or what previous barterers had offered. We showed our wares, voila, like a peddler in the hills in old books. I played a datchip, and from it in language Ezra said, "When my father died, I was sad, but there was a freedom in it too." The hosts reared and said something.
"They've got this one," Bentham said.
They'd played it many times, and it had no more effect. They at last heard it for its content, and they didn't care about Ez's father. We offered other bits from his history, clichés of diplomacy, idle thoughts, weather reports. We gave them for free. "We are very happy about the increased opportunities for technical assistance," and tempted them with the first few phonemes of "I broke my leg when I fell out of a tree."
"They're asking if we have the one about the unacceptable levels of wastage in the refinement industry,"
Ben or Tham said.
"They heard about it from neighbours."
Husbanding carefully, we gave them enough to buy the biorigging we needed, and some expertise, some explanations. Doing so, we spread the addiction, too. We knew that. We brought out pure product, Ezra speech, and these as yet only half-affected outlanders would succumb. I made a similar journey twice more after that first time. Soon afterwards, another of our buoyant dirigible beasts didn't return. When at last our cams found it, they reeled back to us footage and trid of it, dead and strewn in burnt-out flesh and a slick of guts across the countryside. There, drowned in it and shattered, all dead, were our people. Ambassador, navigator, technician, staff. I'd known Ambassador Lee-Nar slightly, one of the crew members, well. I held my mouth closed with my hands as we watched. We were all affected. We fetched back the bodies and honoured them as well as we could, with new ceremonies. Our crews searched the mouldering wreckage.
"The ship wasn't sick, I don't think,"
our investigator told us in committee.
"I don't know what happened."
In Embassy Town we did our best to stand in the way of warlordism, but we small band of ersatz organisers could only slow a degeneration toward that kind of rule. More ambassadors were joining us, terrified into organisation, inspired by Magdar. Others, of course, remained useless. Two more killed themselves. Some deactivated their links. Ez seemed, not calmer perhaps, but more broken, I thought, when I chaperoned him again. Delivering him finally to Ra, though, they argued even more viciously than before.
"I can make things bad for you," Ez kept shouting. "There are things I could say."
When we went into the city, we had to pass the corpses of houses and hosts. The death breakdown of biorigging, designed and bred to be immortal, contaminated the air with unexpected fumes. We heard more Arieke fighting around speakers. Some of their dead died from the violence of the desperate. Some, those without enough of the new sustenance they needed, just died. And in some places, there were more organised brutalities, cadres exerting new kinds of control. The living grabbed what datchips we gave them. These were rewards for these new tough local organisers, in crude concert with which we were just managing to maintain a tenuous system. One evening, as we returned to Embassy Town, I lagged behind my colleagues, shaking the mulch of rotting bridges from my boots. I looked back into the Ariekin city, and I saw two human women looking at me. They were only there a second. They stood one to either side of an alley mouth, meters away, looking at me gravely, and then they were gone. I couldn't have described them well, probably not even recognised them again, but I knew that they had had the same face. It was only later, when things went wrong all over again and these new routines were made bullshit, that I realised I'd come to expect us to muddle through until the ship came and flew us all away. One scheduled evening, we could find neither Ez nor Ra at the time of their broadcast. Neither would answer our buzzes. That was like Ez, but it wasn't like Ra. Ez was in none of his preferred places. We searched the dangerous corridors of the embassy. No one had seen him. We tried to buzz Mag or Dar, who were often with Ra, but they wouldn't answer either. We found the four of them in Mag Dar's new rooms, high in the embassy. There were several of us, constables and new staff like me. When we turned onto the last stretch of hallway, we saw a figure huddled by the apartment door. We levelled our gun things, but she didn't move. It was Dar. As I approached, I thought she was dead. But then she looked up at us, with despair. Into the rooms and to a dreadful scene. Still as a diorama. Mag on the bed in the same precise pose as Dar outside. The wall between them. She looked up at us too, and back at the dead man on the bed with her. It was Ra, quite ruined with blood. A handle emerged from his chest, like a lever. Ez sat away off, rubbing his head and face, smearing blood on himself, blubbing.
I really didn't. It wasn't. Oh, God, it was, look, I'm so it,
he said. And so on. When he saw us, among other emotions, I swear I saw shame broader than for one dead man. He knew what he'd done to all of us. My hand kept twitching as if I'd take the thing out of Ra. Later we found out that at first the argument had been, ostensibly, about Magdar. That was the marshalling of unconvincing, rote things to express other deeper terrors and resentments. The surface specifics didn't really matter. This wasn't about whatever they shouted as they fumbled and implements turned deadly. We weren't very used to murder. It wasn't me who closed Ra's eyes, but it was me who held Mag's hand and led her away. There wasn't much time to just grieve. The ramifications of the situation were obvious. I was already thinking of the tiny stock we had of Ezra pre-recorded on Datchip. When I returned, the others were hauling Ez away and taking Dar to join her doppel. I secured the scene. I was alone for some minutes with Ra's corpse. "Did you have to?" I said. I think I whispered out loud. I was trying hard to keep myself together, and I succeeded. "Couldn't you have backed down?" I put my hand on Ra's face. I looked at him and shook my head, and knew that Embassy Town and I and all the embassy towners would die. Part 5. Notes. 14. We hid the death for days. We were miserable with secrecy. There'd be panic when Embassy Town knew. I couldn't convince myself panic in 3 days' time would be much worse than panic now. Still, we hid it. Like a reflex. We had only a few recordings of Ezra. Ez had been careful. Once we risked repeating a speech that the Arieke had heard before, but the footage we saw of consternation, the fights we spurred among outraged listeners, frightened us. We didn't try that again. We had, perhaps, 20 days of broadcasts. When we played them to the city, we kept them as brief as we dared. New hierarchies were asserting among the hosts, from what we could tell. We didn't understand them. After the murder, Magdar equalized again, for the first time in days. They entered the committee room where we were meeting, smart and unsmiling and precisely identical. I couldn't tell if it was a good or a bad reaction. In any case, it didn't last. They accepted some condolences. They'd lost no authority, remained our de facto leader, listening, debating, and offering their thoughts and almost orders. Obeying Magdar, and out of some prurience, I became Ez's keeper. He wanted a talk. He meandered through self-justification, self-disgust, anger, regret. I'd sit in the room where he was held and listen. At first, I tried to glean the specifics of what had happened. "What was it?" I asked Magdar once. They looked weary. One of them shook her head, and the other said, "That's really not the point." This outcome had been waiting for a long time. Plenty among us advocated simply ending Ez. I and others argued against it. Magdar took our side, which was what settled it. They calculated that an excess of mercy, ultimately, would work for them better than vengefulness. Even at that time, when none of us really believed we had a future, Magdar were planning for it. I pitied Ez, though I despised him too, of course. I felt that as shocking an act as he'd committed should change someone, that he should emerge either better or fully a monster. That he could kill someone and remain the pathetic figure he was previously shocked me. He was idiotic with resentment. He responded to all my questions with a child's churlishness. He wanted to continue telling me his life as he had the hosts with Ra in language. He picked up where they had left off. He didn't come clean about much. He didn't tell us whatever his original task had been, that I was sure he'd had, his and Ra's intended role to undermine Embassy Town's power. His motivations for his secrecy were obscure. Motivations are. I don't know how the news of Ra's death, that he had, I suppose, technically, become Ra under Erasure, got out. But word of his death, and therefore that of Ez Ra, did spread. A guard, a rogue Vespcam, an ambassador, a doppel saying it to a momentary partner, just because it was something that could be said. The knowledge just seemed to well up in Embassy Town. On the fourth day after Ra's death, I woke to church bells. Sects were calling their faithful. Soon I knew the mere knowledge that there was nothing we staff could do wouldn't stop the crowds from marching on us to demand we did anything. Embassy Town would fall, perhaps even before the craving Arieke came for us. In the time that was my own, for various reasons, foremost among them a sudden urgency, a sense that he might understand all this from his weird perspective, might help me, or want help, I started hunting again for Sile. After what Calvin had done with Sile's collaboration, I tried to avoid finding out which other ambassadors were complicit in Tesh-Esh's execution. I couldn't face thinking about it. Cowardice or pragmatism, I don't know. In these latter days, that ignorance was a relief. It was hard enough to live in Embassy Town right then, without relating to my new colleagues with that murder in mind. I did at last meet Calvin, at a gathering of ambassadors, both those on Magdar's committee and those too dissolute or afraid to be. I went straight to them. "Where is he?" I asked Vin. "Sile." This time, I didn't mistake him for his doppel. Neither of them answered me. Bren buzzed me.
"People are being attacked in Carib Alley."
A corvid took constables Magdar and me to the flashpoint in Embassy Town's outskirts. Bren was there already, on the ground, waving us down, torch in his hand. It was night. Down a small street, Arieke were clamouring outside a block. A small group of Tear were inside. They hadn't joined the exodus from this area. "Idiots," someone said. The Arieke were hurling things, rubbish, rock, glass. They each gripped the door in turn, frustrated by its mechanism. They were shouting in language, Ezra's voice, "Where is it?"
"This lot are the weakest," Bren said. "They're too far gone to be satisfied with what we give them now."
we were increasingly parsimonious with the recorded god drug.
They know there are Tear here. Must think they're holding Ezra's voice on Datchip or something.
Don't look like that. This isn't about logic. They're desperate.
Vesp cams gathered. We watched their feeds.
What do you feel, witnessing the end?
In my case, it wasn't despair, but disbelief and shock, endlessly. There, stepped into red mud by the hooves of the Arieke, was a Tear body. A pulped man. I wasn't the only one who cried out at that sight. The cams darted closer. One was slapped from the air by an irate gift wing. Constables touched their weapons, but would we attack the Arieke? We couldn't retaliate. We didn't know what that would invoke.
Officers reached the rear of the buildings, made surreptitious entrances, got the terrified inhabitants away. We watched in split visuals, them with their charges, the hosts clamouring as they attacked the house. There was more motion. Arieke newcomers were approaching.
There, said Bren.
He wasn't surprised by what he saw. There were 4 or 5 new arrivals. I thought they were coming to join the attack on the house, but to my great shock, they shoved in a wedge into the crowd of Arieke with their gift wings whipping. They reared and slammed hooves into their fellows, shattering carapaces. The fight was fast and brutal. Ariekin blood sprayed, and there were the calls of hosts in pain.
Look! I pointed. The cameras flitted and gave me another moment's view of some of the new attackers. Do you see?
They were without fan wings. They had only stumps, flesh rags.
Bren hissed.
The traumatized human inhabitants made it to our flyer, joined us watching that new fight. The attackers killed one of the other Arieke. Seeing it die made me think of Beehive. The host lay there red with hoofprints in familiar gore. Its attacker had slipped in what remained of the Tear man.
So, we have Ariekin protectors now? I said.
No, Bren said. That's not what you just saw.
We moved the last people from the edges of Embassy Town into blocks we could guard with constables and rapidly inducted militia. Some holdouts we forced to leave. Arieke gathered at the ends of streets and watched their human neighbours go. We timed a broadcast of Ezra to coincide with our evacuation. The double voice called, and the Arieke reeled and stampeded to the speakers and left us alone. Between the ruining city and the centre of Embassy Town was a deserted zone. Our buildings, our houses without men and women in them, valuables taken, and only the shoddy and dispensable left behind. I helped supervise the exodus. Afterwards, in the thin air at the edge of the Aeoli breath, I walked through half-empty rooms. Power was still connected. In some places, screens and flats had been left on, and the newscasters talked to me, describing the very removals that had left them alone, interviewing Mag and Dar, who nodded sternly and insisted that this was necessary, temporarily. I sat in empty homes and watched my friends dissemble. I picked up books and trinkets and put them down again. Ursel's rooms were in this zone. I stood outside them, and after a long time I buzzed her. I rang her doorbell. It was the first time I'd tried her in a long time. She didn't answer. The Arieke began to move into the emptied streets, a vanguard of their most desperate. With their pining battery animals, and followed by slow carrion eaters they would have bothered to kill as pests before, the hosts searched the houses too. They pressed with incomprehension and care at computers, their random ministrations running no longer relevant programs, cleaning rooms, working out finances, playing games, organizing the minutiae of those missing. The Arieke found no language to listen to. The absence of their drug didn't wean them of it. There was no cold turkey for them. Ezra's speech had insinuated too deep into them for that. Instead, more of the weakest of them just began to die. Among the Tear, Ambassador Sid Nee committed suicide.
Arvis,
Bren buzzed me.
Can you come to my house?
He was waiting for me. 2 women were with him. They were older than I, but not old. One was by the window, one by Bren's chair. They watched me as I entered. No one spoke. They were identical. They were doppels. I could discern no differences. They weren't just doppels. They were equalized. I was looking at an ambassador. An ambassador I did not recognize. And that, I knew, wasn't possible.
Yes,
Bren said to me. He laughed minutely at my face.
I need to talk to you, he said. I need you to keep quiet about something. Well, about...
One of the women came toward me. She held out her hand.
Avis Ben Acho, she said. Obviously, this is a shock, her doppel said.
Oh, no, I said finally. A shock? Please.
Avis,
Bren said.
Avis, this is ill.
I learnt the spelling later. Y-L.
And this is Sib.
Their faces exactly those of each other. Heavy and shrewd, but they wore different clothes. Ill was in red, Sib in grey. I shook my head. They both wore little aioli, unhooked and resting in our embassy town air. I saw you, I remembered. Once in... I pointed at the city.
Probably, said Sib. I don't remember, said Ill.
Avis, Bren said. Ill Sib are here too. They're how I know what's going on.
Ill Sib. What an ugly name. I knew as he said it that there'd once been Ambassador Sib Ill, and that this recomposition was part of their rebellion.
Ill Sib live in the city,
Bren said gently. Of course they did. He'd hinted to me of such hidden. I realized he was saying my name.
Avis. Avis.
Why me, Bren? I said. I said it quietly enough that it was as if intimate, though Ill and Sib could hear me. Why am I here? Where's Magdar? Where are the others?
No,
he said. He and Sib and Ill glanced at each other.
Too much bad blood. History. Ill Sib and that lot were on opposite sides for a long time. Some things don't change, but you're different, and I need your help.
I was staring into something opened up. Fractures, renegades, guerrilla ambassadors, unquiet cleaved. What the hell else was out there? Who? Sile? Shiftfather Christmas? Back came stupid tales, now not so stupid. I remembered unanswered questions. I wondered who'd gone from Embassy Town, who'd turned their backs on it over years, and I wondered why.
Embassy Town's dying, Ill said.
She gestured at the window, and Sib at the soundless wall screen. The worst, most language-starved Arieke were coming. They shambled in unnatural bursts like toys, troops of the collapsing, falling apart variously, claiming our streets without intent, with only Oriti's despair, but killing as they came, us and each other. We could no longer walk the outermost of our streets. There were too many attacks, too much Ariekin rage. Cams showed those in their dotage instar wandering with pendulous food bellies, some stumbling by their random ways into Embassy Town. No Arieke tended them. It was shocking. There were rumours that in periods between Ezra word highs, some Arieke were eating these unstruggling elders, as evolution intended, but their culture had abjured. Even as things fell apart, I was desperate to ask Ill Sib where they'd been, what had happened, what they'd done since they absconded years ago. They'd lived so close, maybe in some bio-rigged dwelling that sweated air at them inside. Did they consult? Had they worked for the Arieke? Were they independent? Trading in information, go-betweens in informal economies of which I'd never known a thing. There was no way, I thought, such a hinterland could have been sustained without the patronage of some in Embassy Town. You said they weren't helping us, I said, those mad Arieke that came and attacked the others. Bren said,
they weren't.
Ill Sib said, Factions are emerging. Some Arieke can't even think anymore. They're dying. Those are the ones tearing up the outskirts. Then there are some trying to keep some kind of order, live in new ways, manage their addiction. They're trying all kinds of methods, desperate stuff. Repeating phrases they've heard Ezra say to see if they can give each other fixes. Trying to take control of neighbourhoods. Trying to ration out the broadcasts. Organise different listening shifts for different groups to keep things more organised. And then there are dissidents who want to change everything.
We have sects, Bren said. So do they, now. Not ones that worship a god, though. Ones that hate it.
They know the world's ending, said Ilsib, and some of them want to bring in a new one. They despise the other Arieke. That's what you saw. Their word for the addicts was... They said a word together, in language. They used to call them that, Sib or Il said, although they can't anymore. It means weak, sick. It means languid, lotus eaters. They're going to start a new order.
How? I remembered the stubbed and ruined fanwings.
They can't call them that anymore. Because they can't hear or speak. They've no language.
Oh, I said. Oh, God! They did it to themselves!
To escape temptation, Bren said. It's a vicious cure, but it's a cure. Without hearing, their bodies stop needing the drug. And now, the only thing they hate worse than their afflicted brethren is the affliction.
Or, to put it another way, us, said Ilsib. If they'd seen you, they'd have killed you faster than they did their own.
There's not many of them, Bren said, yet. But without Ezra to speak, without the drug, they're the only Arieke with a plan.
The only Arieke, Sib said. We've got one too, though. We have, said Il, a plan. 15. In the out, I'd learned that our embassy isn't a huge building. In countries on many planets, I'd seen much larger. Taller, aided by gravity cranes. More sprawling. But it was large enough. I was only slightly surprised to discover that there were whole corridors, whole floors that by convoluted design I'd not only never been into, but had never even suspected were there.
You know what to do, Ilsib had said to us. You need a replacement. Open the damn infirmary.
That was the basis of their idea, the plan that Bren relayed to Magdar's committee as if it were his own. I wasn't clear on why he'd introduced me to Ilsib, but he was right to trust me. Close to the top of the embassy, in a set of enfolding rooms and halls, was the separated off-zone. I followed those who knew the way. The ambassadors and staff of the committee looked horrified at Bren's suggestion. He insisted, with references incomprehensible to those of the committee ignorant of the infirmary he mentioned. I pretended to be one of them.
There could be others in there we can use, Bren said.
And how are we supposed to know? Said Dar.
Well, that's a difficulty, it said. We're going to have a test subject.
Only streets away, the anarchy of desperate Arieke grew worse, and more of our houses fell. Embassy towners still foolishly near the city would turn corners into those ravenous things who rushed at them and in language begged them to speak, to sound like Ezra sounded. When they didn't, the Arieke took hold of them and opened them up. Perhaps in rage, perhaps in some hope that the wanted sound would emerge from the holes they made. I couldn't believe what we were planning. We'd gone by foot into the city, in a snatch squad. Smoke and birds circled above us. Micropolitics were everything in Embassy Town by then. Groups of men and women enforcing their wills in territories of two or three streets, armed with wrenches, or pistols beasts crudely rigged, that they shouldn't have had to use, that clenched them too tight, drew blood from the weapon hand.
"Where's Ezra then, you fuckers?"
they shouted when they saw us.
"Going to fix everything, are you?"
Some of those posses shouted that they would attack the hosts. If they did, they might take down one or two of the weakest, but against those aggressive self-mutilated, they'd have no chance. Into the ring of Embassy Town we had lost, where the Arieke had been followed by pet weeds. They were already shaggy or crust-like over what had recently been our architecture. The air here was tainted by theirs. We kept our weapons up. Arieke saw us, and now it was they who shouted, came forward, ran away. "Ezra! Ezra! The voice! Where is the voice?"
"Don't kill unless you really have to," said Dar.
We found a lone Ariekes, turning, pining for words.
"Come with us," Magdar said.
"Ezra," the Ariekes said.
"Come with us," Magdar said, "and you will hear Ezra."
We buzzed a corvid. It was antique, metal and silicon and polymers. Entirely Tertek. We were chary of using our more sophisticated machines now. They were built with a compromise of our traditions and local biorigging, and as addiction spread, they might be tainted. For all we knew, they might gush that need if we flew them, in their exhaust, perhaps in the tone of their drone. The Ariekes who came with us was called Tuash. It was confused and overcome by need for the god drug's voice. It was physically starving, too, though it didn't seem to know it. We gave it food. It followed us because we made promises about Ezra. We took it with us to the infirmary. I wasn't the only ex-commoner on the committee who hadn't known the wing existed. By a series of counterintuitive corridor turns and staircases, we arrived at a heavy door. There was even a guard. Security, in this time when all officers were needed.
"Got your message, Ambassador," he said to Magdar. "I'm still not sure I can... I..."
He looked at us. He saw the cowed Ariekes with us.
"We're in martial times, officer," Magdar said. "You don't really think that the old laws apply. Let us in."
Inside, uniformed staff met us and made us welcome. Their anxiety was palpable, but muted compared to everyone else's. There was a pretend normality in those secret halls. It was the only place I'd been for weeks where rhythms didn't seem utterly sideswiped by the crisis. Carers went with drugs and charts in and out of rooms. I got the sense that this crew would continue with these day-to-day activities until word-starved Arieke broke through their doors and killed them. I suppose there were other institutions in Embassy Town where the dynamic of the quotidian sustained. Some hospitals, perhaps some schools. Perhaps houses where shift parents most deeply love the children. Whenever any society dies, there must be heroes whose fight back is not to change. The infirmary was infirmary and asylum and jail for failed ambassadors.
"As if it would work every time you tried to make two people into one,"
Bren whispered to me in scorn. Ambassadors were bred in waves. We passed rooms of men and women all the same generation. First through the corridor of the middle-aged, incarcerated failures more than half a mega-hour old, staring at the cams and at the one-way glass that kept us invisible. I saw doppels in separated chambers, unlinked, I suppose, or linked loosely enough that the wall between them caused no discomfort. Looking into room after room, I saw faces twice, twice, twice. Some cells were empty and windowless and spare. Some opulent with fabrics, looking out over Embassy Town and the city. There were inmates secured or limited by electronic tags, even straps. Mostly the infirm, as one of the doctors who guided us called them, said nothing. But one of those buckled in constraints screamed inventive filth at us. How she knew we were passing beyond the opaque glass, I don't know. We saw her mouth move, and the doctor pressed a button that for a few seconds let us hear her. I disliked him for it a great deal. Everything was clean. There were flowers. Wherever possible, over double rooms, was the printed name of those inside with honorific. Ambassador Herr Rott,
Ambassador Justin, Ambassador Dagny. Some had simply never had the empathy they'd needed to pretend to share a mind, had only ever been two people who looked the same, despite training, drugs, the link, and coercions. Many were insane to different degrees. Even if they had facility with language, they'd been left unstable, resentful, melancholic, dangerous. There were those who'd been made mad through cleavage, who hadn't, as Bren had, been able to survive the death of a doppel. They were broken half-people. There was a huge variety of the failed, many more than their ambassadors. I was horrified at these numbers. I never knew, I told myself. We were too civilized to end them, hence this polite prison where we waited for them to die. I knew enough Tear history to assume that some of these failed must be counted so, because of political refusals. I was reading every nameplate we passed, and I realized it was for names I recognized. Like Dalton, those of dissidents of whom only bad citizens like me spoke. No sign. Past an extreme section, men and women older than my shift parents baying like animals, and those talking with careful civility on comms to their carers, or to no one. Christ, I said. Christ, Farotecton. In its withdrawal, Tuash, unthinkably defecated. It realized what it had done and said something in shame. The action was as taboo for the hosts as for us. I think the doctors deliberately took us a long way to our destination. A room where we could hold our auditions. So we were voyeurs on chamber after chamber. We passed walls painted in brighter colours, where screens were uploaded with playware. And God help me, the aesthetics were so incongruous that it took me seconds to understand. This was where they brought Ambassador Young, some just 50 kilo hours old. I didn't look through the windows in those doors, and I'm glad I didn't see the unfixable children. In a large room, we asked Tuash to pay attention. One by one, the doctors brought in what they thought the most likely candidates, all of them under guard. Those who'd never mastered language were no good to us, nor those too unstable. But some pairs, held almost all their lives, had been incarcerated for nothing but that there was something lacking when they spoke language, a component we couldn't detect. Many of them retained a startling degree of sanity. Those were the people we tried. An aging duo stood before us, men without any easy ambassador arrogance. Instead, they seemed inadequate to the courtesy we gave them. They were named Xerxes. The Ariekis entranced them. They'd seen no hosts for years. They could once speak language, a doctor told us. Then suddenly they stopped being able to. We don't know why. Xerxes had a polite and uninquisitive affect. Do you remember language, Ambassador Xerxes? Dar said.
What a question! What a question!
Xerxes said.
We're an ambassador! We're an ambassador!
Would you greet our guest for us? They looked out of the window. Sectors of the city were listless and discoloured in withdrawal, overrun by Wens.
Greet them, said Xerxes. Greet them?
They muttered together. They prepared, lengthily, whispering, nodding. We got impatient. They spoke. Classic words that even I knew well.
Shuhea, Shuhea,
they said. It's pleasing to greet you and have you here. The Ariekis snapped its eye coral up. I thought, because I wanted to, that it was like the motion Arieke made when they heard Ezra speak. Shoash peered slowly around the room. It was just looking because there had been a new noise in the room. It might have reacted the same had I dropped a glass. It lost interest. Xerxes spoke again, something like, "Would you speak now to me?" The Ariekis ignored them, and Xerxes spoke again, and their voice fell apart, degraded, the cut and turn, each saying half of a different entreaty. It wasn't pleasant. I don't quite believe there was no language in it.
I think there was something, a remnant, in what the Ariekis heard. I thought back to what I saw, to the way it moved, and I don't believe in fact it was exactly as it would have been to random noise. It made no difference. Wasn't enough. But there was, I think, in Xerxes, and I don't know how many others, the ghost of language. Ambassador Xerxes were taken back to their rooms. They went tamely. One looked at us with, I swear, apology as he shuffled to his imprisonment. Others, older first, younger, then, appallingly, two sets of adolescents desperate to please us. Some were equalized and dressed the same, some were not. A pair about my age, Fay Riss, attempted cold defiance, but still tried desperately to speak language when we asked them to. Shoash stared at them and recognized something, but not enough. Fay Riss were the first of our candidates to curse us as they were taken, dragged away. I stared at Magdar. I liked them. I admired them. They'd known about this. We met 17 ambassadors. 12 sounded to me as if they were speaking language. 9 seemed to have some kind of an effect on the Ariekis. 3 times I wondered if we had found what Il Sib had hoped we might. What we were looking for, to take Ezra's place and keep Embassy Town alive. But whatever they had wasn't enough. If Ezra's language was a drug, I thought, perhaps some other ambassadors, one day, would be a poison. We played Shoash, one of the last datchips. It slumped and shuddered at Ezra's meanderings about the biggest tree Ez had ever climbed. There was nothing in the infirmary that could help us.
"You can't replicate that," a doctor said. "These," she indicated the imprisoned mistakes beyond our room, "they have imperfections. That's not what there was in Ezra. Two random people should not be able to speak language. You won't find anything like that. It wasn't just unlikely that we'd find Ezra the first time. It was impossible. How do you propose to find it again?" No wonder Ezra couldn't survive. The universe had had to correct itself. We sat in committee. "We have to close this place," I said.
"Not now, Avis," Magdar said.
"It's monstrous."
"Not now, Christ. There's not going to be anything to close, or any of us to close it, if we don't bloody think."
So, silence. Once every minute or so, someone around the table would look as if he or she was about to say something, but none of us had anything. Someone was sniffing as if they might cry. Magdar whispered to each other.
"Get what researchers you can in here," they said at last. "Riggers, bios, medics, linguists. Anyone you can think of. This Ariekis. Shoash."
They looked at each other.
"Do what you have to. Test it. Take it apart."
They waited for dissent. There was none.
"Take it apart and see if you can find out what's happening. Inside. In its bone house."
They glanced at Bren and me.
"When it hears Ezra, see if you can find out anything. Maybe we can synth it that way."
Like that, by that leadership, we would murder a host. Not even in self-defense, but calculation. Embassy Town became something new. I was in awe of Mag and Dar for their bravery. It was a dreadful act. Magdar had known it had to come from them. I don't think any of us thought we'd discover in the Ariekis innards any secrets to its addiction. But we'd try. And, too, we were all going to die soon, and it was time for new paradigms, and Magdar gave us one. They took it on themselves to tell us what it meant to be at war. They gave us a dirty hope. It was one of the most selfless things I'd ever seen. 16. The vivisection on the addict in the infirmary told us nothing. Within days, Embassy Town knew that the committee had tried to stave off what was coming, to create a new Ezra,
and had failed. Words spread because word will spread. Stories and secrets fight. Stories win, shed new secrets, which new stories fight, and on. Mag and Dar had us go to war. Too late. Those of us not despairing put up barricades. We'd surrendered the edges of Embassy Town. Now, some streets in, we hauled out the contents of deserted houses, broke them up, and threw them across our streets. Earth movers cut trenches and piled up the ruins of our roads and the Ariekin earth below them into sloped revetments. We hardened them with plaster and concrete, stationed shooters to protect the remains of our town in the city from Arieke in need. Buildings became gun towers. We'd always had a few weapons, to which we added those taken from the Bremen caches, and engineers and riggers made new ordnance. We checked all our technology for bio-rigged components, destroyed it at any sign of addiction. We burned the tainted, squealing machines in autos de fe of heretic technology. All this was too late, we knew. Ambassador Edgar hanged themselves. Edgar had been on the committee. Their suicides shocked us all over again. Ambassadors were suicide pioneers, and other embassy towners copied them. Men and women would suit up by the barriers at our borders, aioli breathing into them, holding knives, clubs, guns they had made or bred. They'd trudge over our fortifications and into territory that had recently just been the street, was now Badlands. They left us, swivelling at side streets, weapons out in manoeuvres copied from the forays of our constables and the Charo city-set policing dramas imported in the Mayabs. Sometimes, at the limits of our vision, the Arieke would wait for them, by sickly indigenous buildings. We didn't try to stop these one-way explorers. I doubt they thought they would escape Embassy Town's fate by walking into bad air, into an exot city gone bad. I think they just wanted to do something. We called them the Morituri. After the first few, little crowds began to come, to cheer them as they went. The Arieke were horrifying now. All were sick and starving. They were thin or strangely distended by hunger gases. Their eyes were unfamiliar colours. They jerked or dragged limbs that didn't behave. Their fan wings quivered. Some still tried to work with us. They strived against their addiction. They gathered at the base of the barriers, ostentatiously not attempting to breach them, to prove goodwill. They would call us. We would fetch Magdar or Randolph, or another ambassador on the committee, and they would attempt to parley. Sometimes the hosts left us energy, fuel, miraculously untainted bio-rigging. We gave them the food or medicines they were no longer able to make. We promised them Ezra's voice, which was all they begged for. Whatever inklings they had about how lies worked, about the nature of our promise, they showed no suspicion. They waited hopelessly. Often they dispersed only when driven away by their less controlled siblings. The most desperate orates, incapable of planning, would come full tilt at the barricades, leap far and fast up them, grabbing with gift wings, shouting in language. We repelled them. We killed them when we had to. I've seen Arieke shot, blown apart by explosives, burnt by the caustic sputum of bio-rigging, cut with blades. When anyone killed their first Ariekis, a life of conditioned respect would break. Gunners would weep. The second time, not. Animals infiltrated the lost streets. Altbrocks, foxes, monkeys moving curiously down wheel ruts. Truncators climbed drainpipes and worried at loosening windows. Once in a while, some depressive guard would shoot one and the beasts would scatter. But it quickly became bad luck to kill a tear beast. It became instead a sport to take out the fluttering, tottering, strangely walking Ariekin animals that also came. No one was sure whether trunks, neither tear nor indigene, were targets or not, and they were left alone. We avoided thinking about our inadequate stocks of food, of energy, of the stuff we needed. A narrative went up with our walls of torn-up rubbish, of last stands and resistance, the onslaught of hordes. It helped. In the evenings, people gathered in the little neighbourhoods left to us. I was surprised at what gave us comfort. Artists plumbed our archives, digital archaeology, back millions of hours,
to the anti-diasporan age. They pulled up corroded ancient fictions to screen.
"These ones are Georgian or Roman, I gather,"
one organiser told me.
"They talk early Anglo, though."
Men and women bled of colour, in clumsy symbolism, fortified in a house and fighting grossly sick figures. Colour came back, and protagonists were in an edifice full of products, and sicker enemies than before relentlessly came for them. We read the story as ours, of course. We knew the Arieke would breach our defences. They entered the houses that edged our zone, found their ways to rear and side doors, large windows, to holes. Some came out of the front doors into our streets and tore apart what they found. Those with remnants of memory tried to get to the embassy. They came at night. They were like monsters in the dark, like figures from children's books. There were other dangers. There were human bandits. A rumour circulated that one group of criminals included Kedis and Shirasi, as well as Tear. There was no evidence. Still, when, by what was certainly human action, a Shirasi was found dead by a main barricade, the excuse was whispered that it had been part of that predatory gang. They only died by violence or mishap, and for that race, the death, every Shirasi death, was an abomination as epic as the fall. Not all the Ariekin corpses we cleared were killed by us, nor by the random brutality of other afflicted hosts. Some were destroyed with what seemed a more deliberate alien savagery.
"That's those we saw," Bren told me, "without their fan wings. We're worrying about the addicts, but we need to think about them too."
"Where are Ilsib?" I said.
"They're not lunatics, you know," he said. "There are ways of being in the city. Ill, Sib, and others. You know ambassading doesn't always take."
"That place has to close, Bren. Christ, those people can't be kept like that."
"I know."
I stayed the night with him for the second time. We said even less than we had the first time, but that was really all right. As all right as it got that night. "Do you think there are languages made up of three voices?" I asked him at one point.
"It's a big out," he said. "Sure, and four, and five,"
I said, "and places where exots speak Anglo in ways that mess up human heads." We stood naked by his window, his arm over my shoulder and mine around his waist, and listened to fires. Shouts. Shattering. Bren got a buzz early the next morning. He would not say from whom, to my anger. He raced us to the border. A tide of Arieke were coming. They galloped at the barricades in a wave, an invasion organised with last gasps of sentience. "I very much stress that I wish to hear the voice of Ezra, please," the Arieke shouted as they came to kill us. "Is there a possibility that we could hear Ezra speak?" The guards were calling for backup. Magdar, our comrades and staff, came. With animal guns fast bred without ears, with rapidly machino-factured bullets, with hurled clubs and polymer crossbows firing quarrels made of reclaimed steroids, we staved the hosts off. Arieke burst, screaming their polite requests. "We most sincerely ask..." Zell scuttled up our barriers, and we shot them too. Kedis were with us. There were Shirasi playing out electrified wires. I saw Simon firing expertly with what had once been his off arm. With only the tiniest organising, the Arieke would have taken us, but they were drugless and incompetent. They had to clamber over hillocks of their dead. Scavengers came, wild house antibodies. Our own birds tasted the air over the carnage and arced away again. My eyes were watering from acrid Ariekine innards. There was a commotion from side streets. Something was slamming into the hosts. I shouted for Bren's attention. It was a mass of those other, self-mutilated Arieke. They'd come hidden among the others, a fifth column. Bren watched them without expression, while the rest of us gaped, as they dispersed our junky attackers brutally. "Bren was the first here," Dar said quietly to me. She looked over to where Mag spoke to him. "With you." He knew this would happen, didn't he? How?
I shook my head. He knows people.
Do you?
I wasn't going to mention Ilsib. Dar was no fool. It wouldn't have surprised me if she was aware of everything, including relevant names.
Come on, I said. What do you know, Avis?
I didn't answer, but I met her eye to make sure I didn't seem embarrassed or ashamed. So if she could tell I was holding back, she knew it was because I was trying to show respect for something. I was buzzed right then, from an ID I didn't recognize. Sound only, no trid or flat. The voice was muffled, beyond recognition.
Say that again, I shouted. Who is this? Say that again.
Whoever it was did, and that time I heard. I held my breath and hoped I was wrong and put it to speaker, so Mag and Dar and Bren could hear. But I was right. The words came one more time, much clearer.
Calvin's dead.
All we found in their rooms was the detritus of drink and of sex. There was no answer on Calvin's buzz. We went to clubs they'd been known to visit, where to my disgust a last fervent few were still trying to blot out the end of the world. They told us Calvin hadn't been there for days. The last time they'd been accompanied by some uninterested man. Down to other bars, and nothing, and still nothing. I knew abruptly who had been with Calvin. We took a route to where I'd once lived, where Sile had once lived, and to which now that I'd gone, he'd returned. My key still worked. Sile's stuff was everywhere. The flat was all his now, but he was absent. There was a note from him, to me, on the bed that had once been ours. It had been opened already. I unfolded it just enough to read the line, "This is to say goodbye," and stopped. Calvin were in another room. The message had been wrong. Calvin wasn't dead. Vin was dead. He dangled. Cal was watching him move, pendulum precise. I saw another note, on another mattress. Cal looked at me. God knows what he saw in my face right then.
"I didn't feel it," he said. "I didn't know, I..."
He touched his neck, his link.
"It was...